Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
You know the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here. Dug our treasures there. But can't you still recall the time we cried? Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
The Doors, and Break On Through to the Other Side. And that's from their eponymous debut album, released on the 4th of January 1967 on the Elektra record label. Now, it was released as an edited single on the 24th of April in 67. It spent 3 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 charts and 1 week on the Cashbox 200 charts, but it only charted at number 49 in the UK.
You know, every time I listen to The Doors...
Yeah.
Well, A, they're very unmistakable, and it's not actually the vocal. The vocal is great. It's a great vocal, but it's all about that keyboard, isn't it? It's all about that Ray Manzarek Vox Continental thing. It's Fender Rhodes piano, black bass, yeah. And every time you hear it, that's the only thing that really... Well, no, it's not the only thing, but it's an outstanding sound. It just captures you straight away, doesn't it? It goes bang, 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 bang. And it also never ceased to amaze me that Robbie Krieger's guitar sounds so terrible. It's like horrible, but great. It's, you know, if you listen to, it's like Spirit in the Sky. Listen to Norm Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky, right? And when that guitar comes in, that, right? And it was done with a Telecaster with some inbuilt fuzz, and it's horrible.
Yeah,
if you played that at home or at a gig or something, you think, "God, it's a terrible sound," but it's perfect. And the thing about Robbie Krieger's guitar, it's perfect. You know, as a match, and with Jim Morrison sort of just, you know, doing his snake hippie thing over the top, and we're going through, you know, all that sort of, it's great. But such an amazing thing. And you know, again, this week's show is all about 1967.
Yes.
And I can't, you know, every week now, is this the fourth show we've done? I can't believe the quantity and quality of the show. And this week's slightly different show, because we've taken it away a little bit from more rock and blues and stuff. And we're moving into slightly other areas this particular week.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just great. And this song, though, is a remarkable feat of new sound, isn't it? Because the Doors, the name, came from, was it an Aldous Huxley
book? That's right, his book, Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception. Yeah. It was also mentioned in William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Mm. He says, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everyone would appear to man as it is, infinite.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, you know, but I've got to say, the reason why we've started this show again with The Doors is because it feels like 1967.
It does.
And it sets the whole feel.
Yeah.
And you're right. I so get what you say about the Vox and about Ray Manzarek. And did you know that that he was saying his keyboard bass, because they did the second album, you know, this year in 67.
Right.
They recorded Strange Days in between touring, between like May and August at the
Is
same
that right?
place. Yeah. But they had an 8-track recorder this time. And so what happened was that they flipped out because they got an advanced copy of Sgt. Pepper. And they went, oh, my God, the Beatles are amazing. And so it inspired them to try and basically do another Sgt. Pepper. So this is for their second album. They had an 8-track and they did loads more sort of soundscape experimentation. Mm. But this is when Ray was saying that the keyboard bass is good. It's great live, but it lacks articulation when it's recorded.
Yeah.
So, and that makes sense too. So for everybody playing live, right, okay, if you don't want a real bass player like me on the scene and you do the bass with the keys, I can accept that. But just so you know, in the studio, Ray said...
Ray,
yeah. My mate Ray, that, you know...
Well, I think perhaps you'd have a word with John Paul Jones about that, because I think he made a pretty good... I think he did a really good job in the records and live.
I know, and it's about like, and everyone plays more than four strings as well, you know, give me a pair of snippers and I'll snip them back to four. That's all they need. They're just, I don't know, it's like a fad, you know, it's like, get back to your job.
Yeah, and this was produced by Paul Rothchild, of course, and Bruce Botnick, the engineer.
Yeah.
And was it Paul Rothchild who introduced the Doors to...
Well, there's a story here.
Yeah.
You know, our favourite song from 67, like the top five, you know, Love.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Arthur Lee from Love, he recommended the Doors to the president of Elektra Records, Jack Holdsman.
Ah.
So he went along with the producer, Paul Rothchild, saw them live, and then they signed them.
Right, at the Whiskey A-Go-Go.
Yeah, because they started off, this is great, though, because sometimes you like to just, because we've had the Doors on the show a few times.
Mm.
So, you know, I'm just doing a little bit more delving. So in early 66, the band had a residency at the rundown and sleazy Los Angeles club called London Fog, and they appeared on the bill with Rhonda Lane, Exotic Dancer. I think that's great. And Ray was saying that it was there that they became this collective, this kind of unit of oneness. And that's where the magic in the band started happening. Because Jim got more confident as well as a performer when he was in London Fog. And then they soon went up to the Whiskey A Go-Go. And they were opening for acts like, you know, Van Morrison and them.
Mm.
And they joined on the last night and had like a 20-minute jam of Gloria, you know.
Yeah,
so
what a great song.
You could see them... And it happens. I mean, we know this. You know, when you start to play more and you go in different environments, things change. Us as a musician, you just grow, don't you?
Well, it always brings. When you mentioned exotic dancers, then I remember playing Newcastle Labour Club with an exotic dancer once at a lunchtime, a Sunday lunchtime, with our band Whitefire at the time, and I have never felt anything like it. It was an amazing, surreal experience.
Over bridge of sights, to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spires, to Ichiku Park, that's where I've been.
What did you do there? You feel there?
Well, I cry.
Why the tears there?
Tell you why.
It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I'm inclined to blow my mind. Get it all off the decks for that month. Come out. what I'll do.
What will you do?
I'd like to go there now with you. You can miss out school.
Won't that be
why
cool?
Go to learn the words of
what will you do there?
We'll get high.
What will we touch there?
We'll touch the sky.
But why the cheese there?
They all come out to cool the night. The mice on top are in the sea.
It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. Ha! It's all.
Small Faces and Ichiku Park, of course, released on the 4th of August 1967 on the Immediate record label, formed by Andrew Luke Oldham and Tony Calder. Written and produced by Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane, of course, and Ronnie Lane later on. He worked, you know, an awful lot on records with the Faces because he played on bass and he did a lot of vocals as well, which is unusual because Rod Stewart, of course, is an incredible vocalist.
Yes.
And they were like sharing vocal duties. It was very odd. They had a lead singer, then him playing bass and singing. But back to the Small Faces. And it was recorded at our favourite studio in the whole world, Olympic Studios, through a Helios console, where they were given a virtual open account after splitting with manager Don Arden. And Decca Records.
Yeah.
It went to the number three in the UK singles charts, number 16 in the US, and number one in Canada.
Good taste, hey, the Canadians.
But the track is all about the phasing effect. Now, if anybody, if you can't, everybody's heard it. It comes like that, and it's phasing on that. They went phasing mad, there's phasing on the vocals. It's not just the drums. It's just that break at the end that you really notice it, you know. But in that little psychedelic bit, there's some phasing on that as well.
Special effect.
Yeah, and this phasing was brand new. And how they did it in those days, it was done with two tape machines. And, you know, I actually need to look it up again because I've never done it myself. I've heard about it, I've read about it, but to actually do it is something else, you know.
Yeah.
Now you have electronic devices, you know, to do this. But most sources credit the engineer, George Chicanes, who I can never pronounce his name.
No, nor me.
who showed it to the Small Faces regular engineer, the mighty Glyn Johns. And this George character, it pops up all the time in Olympic Studios. And when you read the books, which I've read many now, he is a masterful engineer. And he's really just disappeared because, you know, everybody talks about Glyn Johns. Everybody talks about all these great engineers, you know. But you know, Jeff Emmerich and all these guys. But this guy was really innovative.
It's like, who is George, isn't
it? Yeah, and he was like he was really like the Jeff Emmerich of Olympic. And, you know, amazing stuff. But great song, again, from 1967.
I think this kind of era as well, I still, every time I'm researching, I still get... I'm stunned by the fact that everyone just wants a sound, you know, because I, as a musician, you think, oh, yeah, I want to write a kick-ass song, you know, or a beautiful ballad or just a really a great song, you know. And yet so many times it's like you get this song, but it's how the treatment of it, it's the sound you apply to it, it's how you make it sound.
That's right.
And not just the structure of the song that makes it great. And everyone's obsessed by it, aren't they? In that era as well. And I think probably now, I mean, you see lots of different people, don't you? All trying to find an angle, something fresh. But it's I suppose maybe just because it was tape and it was 4-track, then 8-track, and so it just opened up possibilities, isn't it? It's like, you know, yeah, having a fixed line phone and then getting a mobile, you know.
You see, I think that, you know, talking about production, it's a very odd thing, because now people, I think, massively overproduce records. They don't let the song shine through. And I just wonder, are there any great songs out there? I mean, there are occasionally, we hear them, they'll come on, you know, on our radar, and we sort of go, wow, what's a fantastic song.
Yeah.
But you listen to 1967, and there were great songs.
Yeah.
But there were great songs with great innovative production. I mean, we talked about The Doors, you know, the first track there, with that keyboard, that Vox Continental, which was very much the sound of that. It was very much the sound of The Animals. It was that it had a thing, it had a sound, you know. And this, you know, and the Small Faces made a big point out of this phasing, but it's a great song anyway. It is a great song.
Well, of course, they were founded in 65 with Steve Marriott, Ronnie Lane, Kenny Jones and Jimmy Winston. And I have to look at that because I'm trying to not get confused with other bands, yeah?
Yeah, well, it's very easy in this.
I know,
time.
Tell me about it, because I keep asking, you know, the Small Faces, then the Faces. So by 66, Winston had left and Ian McLagan took over as the keyboard. And they were saying with Itchy Coo Park, it's like the R&B came from Detroit and the music hall came from Stepney.
Yeah.
So they have this thing, and they were saying like Itchy Coo Park is about having a drink at a party, but I didn't know that the BBC banned it, you know.
No.
Yeah, initially they banned it because it's apparently had over drug references.
Mm.
So Steve Marriott and the manager Tony Calder scammed the BBC with the story that Itchy Coo Park was a piece of waste ground in the East End that the band had played on as kids. And they put that story out like 10 o'clock in the morning, and by midday the ban had been lifted.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rains came down in the hollow, playing a new game, laughing. Skipping and a jumping in the misty morning fog with all our hearts a thumping, and you, my brown eyed girl, and you, my brown eyed girl, and whatever happened to Tuesday and so slow. Gone down the old mine with a transistor radio, standing in the sunlight laughing, hiding behind a rainbow's wall, slipping and sliding all along the waterfall with you, my brown-eyed girl. We used to sing sha la 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 la, just like that. Sha la 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 la. You have grown, cast my memory back there, Lord. Sometimes I'm overcome thinking about it. Making love in the green grass behind the stadium with you, my brown eyed girl. And you, my brown eyed girl, do you remember when we used to sing sha la 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 la
Van Morrison and Brown Eyed Girl from his debut solo album Blowing Your Mind, released in September 67 on Bang Records.
Bang.
It was also released as a single in June 67. It peaked at number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. But Van doesn't regard this record as a true album because Burt Burns, who owned Bang.
Burt Burns of Bang.
That's a good job. It's not R, isn't it? It's the Roderick Riddy of whatever. Anyway, Burt from Bang, right, he compiled and released it without Van's consent.
No.
Yeah. Git.
Well, you know, we were just talking about a sound.
Yes.
And this is really Van's signature song, isn't it? I mean, it's an incredible song, beautifully sung, happy. It gives a good, warm, gushing feeling, like Sweet Caroline. From,
yeah,
you know,
I get
from
where
Neil
from
Diamond,
there.
It's that thing, and it sounds great. But it's all about those two parts, the bass part and the guitar part. Now, the sound wasn't revolutionary. There's some claps on there. It's all quite simple. It was recorded at A&R Studios in New York, in New York Session Men. But those parts make that song. They contribute to the melody and the whole artistic thing of that record. And that is something that a session musician, you know, can bring to a record. And, you know, you hear so many. Larry Carlton with Steely Dan. He made, you know, some of those tracks come alive with those solos he did. Vinnie Colaiuta, the drummer, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and these guys, amazing.
Mm.
You know, Dennis Davis with David Bowie in that great rhythm section.
Carole Kaye on bass.
Carole Kaye.
With the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, and the Wrecking Crew, generally speaking, they were pumping out stuff like No Tomorrow.
Yeah.
And but these people, their artistry and their skill contributed to the song. And it wasn't an arrangement per se. I mean, you know, in those days when they were doing this, you know, a session musician, they'd have the dots. That have now, of course, they have the dots. People, that's the music in front of them so that they can, you know, play what has been written out for them. Mm. But I bet these guys came up with that part on their own. That does not sound like it's been arranged.
Ah, it's really interesting because when you look at the bands and when they were recording then, a lot of people really weren't very good musicians, and that's why you had these session guys
who'd right,
come
yeah.
in, and because money was tight, they were of a certain caliber of professionalism that they could knock out a song in a couple of hours, and that's how they got it done. It's like the Monkees, they weren't allowed to play, were they, on their first
That's right, on the first record, yeah.
No, until they proved that, and insisted, until they got up to scratch, you know. And it's even like with George Martin.
Yeah.
He didn't like Ringo's drumming.
He didn't.
So it's so when you look at the culture
Well, the Beatles
this,
at the beginning, I mean, you know, George Martin said, and Jeff Emerick, I mean, apparently they were pretty scrappy, even though they've been playing in live, because there's a difference, as we all know, between playing live and exciting an audience and then getting in a studio where every note is scrutinized.
I don't think people realize, unless you actually have experienced it yourself, if you play an instrument and you play it live, I don't think a lot of people really realize that actually it's a different craft completely.
Oh, it is, yeah.
And that, and I always tell musicians when they come in to record with us as well, that it's an experiment with sound, that you've got to kind of find how you imagine your sound to be, and then we'll find it together, and then we'll go past that, because it, once you start moving in that area, everything changes, doesn't it? Evolves, it becomes this amazing adventure. And sometimes it's really painful because you think a song's going to go a certain way and it doesn't. So you can never tell until you get to record it. That's it.
Yeah, and you know, and that's, you're talking about that sound. I mean, and talking about the bass there, I bet pound to a penny that's been done with an Ampeg Portaflex 1/15. He was using a pick with flatwound strings. That's it. You can tell instantly, and it has the punch, and it has all those things, and it sounds amazingly good, and his part is great. But it's that type of detail that, you know. But when you listen, and you well know this, certainly as a bass player, guitar, you know, because now everybody plays with loads of distortion. I tend to play with a little distortion, you know, and it is very, very difficult, you know, to play rock and roll guitar pretty clean, you know, because it's got, you've got to be really accurate. You know, the more distortion, the more fuzz and stuff you've got on it, the easier it is to play, because you can skip stuff and it's a bit of a mess and you can't really. But with bass, it's got to be absolutely accurate. And, you know, you can clank, as you well know, if you play it too hard, the strings slap against the frets and it clonks. And
I always aim for that bit for the groove, the feel. The feel is really important to me.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get a note right, but it's got, as you say, it's got a feel in its place, and then it kind of sets the whole emotion and tone for the song. But, you know, the sign of the times as well with Van, when he released this, right, the song's nostalgic lyrics were about a former love, but they were considered too suggestive, right, at the time.
No.
Yeah, on many radio stations. So they had to do a special radio edit, so which removed the lyrics, making love in the green grass, and replaced them with laughing and a running. Hey, hey.
Is that right?
Hey, hey.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon?
We could float among the stars together, you and I.
For we can fly. Up and away.
Fifth Dimension. Now that sort of sounds like 1967 straight away. Up, Up and Away, the title track from their debut album, released on May 1967 on the Soul City record label. Written by American songwriter Jimmy Webb, who also wrote MacArthur Park. Now, just before I continue with the story of this, MacArthur Park, there's a great, great YouTube video. And there's a session bass player doing an amazing
cover. I remember
cover.
That.
And Jimmy Webb is actually playing, he plays, I think it's Hammond or piano, and it's the CBS, I think it's in the studio, and it's CBS band, and there's a right. wonderful woman on guitar.
In the next link, while we play the next song, I'll have a look and we'll let you know who it is. You can yeah. check it out, because that version of MacArthur Park is stunning.
It yeah, really yeah. is.
It's a little bit American towards the end, but I'm not going to spoil it.
Yeah,
okay?
yeah. You've got to watch it. It's a must-watch thing. But Jimmy Webb, interestingly enough, works with our Australian keyboard player because Clayton Doley, who played with us at Wangaratta last year, and hopefully when we do some dates in Australia in the future, he'll be playing with us. He actually is the arranger for Jimmy Webb, and we keep seeing him popping up all over the world playing keyboards for Jimmy Webb. And the last time I saw him, he was at the Blasted Sydney Opera House with Jimmy Webb. And he actually arranged all the blasted strings and everything. It was a marvellous thing. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, I'm so impressed.
So I think
that's
it was about...
so cool.
2 months before... 2 months after, I should say, we played at Wangaratta. There he was in Royal Opera House with Jimmy Webb. Anyway, he actually wrote this. And it reached number 7 in the US pop singles charts, number 9 on the Billboard Easy Listening charts, and number 1 in Canada and Australia.
But you do not realise, you know, because when we programmed the show, we played through all the songs that we liked, went, yeah, and I double-checked, yeah. So this song, I've been waiting to put it in because doesn't it feel like 1967?
It does.
But a different facet of the Rubik's Cube of that year.
Totally.
And every time I hear it, I'm going, ah, oh, and it's a classic example of sunshine pop.
It is.
Bubblegum pop, sunshine pop. But this song, right, it cleaned up at the 10th Annual Grammy Awards. Get this, right, in 68 it won Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best Pop Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocals, Best Performance by a Vocal Group, and Best Performance by a Chorus, and Best Contemporary Song. I mean, this shot Jimmy Webb and the band into superstardom. It really did. And this was their third single release. And after that, they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. Obviously, didn't have any dodgy lyrics, so they could come back again.
Of course,
like the Doors,
yeah.
You know. You know, it was just, I mean, fantastic. But I didn't know the name of the band, The Fifth Dimension. I know the song.
Yeah. Well, you do, and that's the thing. I mean, all these songs you just know, don't you, instinctively? And just talking about session players, the Wrecking Crew were the backing band for this, and it's more than likely, listening to that bass, it was blasted Carol Kay again, Hal Blaine on drums, who recently passed away, Al Casey on guitar. But, you know, amazing.
But it's also another indication of this era, and I think still now that people swap and change because, like, back in 64, some of the band members actually were on tour with Ray Charles, you know, in a backing band called the Hi-Fi.
Right.
And then they auditioned for Mark Gordon, who had headed up Motown's LA office, but he rejected their demo, but he agreed to manage them. So it's like you just never know what's going to happen. But in this year as well, it was actually Bing Crosby recorded a version of this, would you believe?
Wow.
Right. It was recorded, he released it in 1968 on his album called Thoroughly Modern Bing. So you have Up, Up and Away, and other tracks on his album were Talk to the Animals, Puff the Magic Dragon,
no.
And Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead. Spencer Davis Group, I'm a Man. And that was released as a single in January 67 on the Fontana record label in the UK and United Artists in the US of A. It went to number 9 in the UK singles charts and number 10 in the Billboard Hot 100.
Steve Winwood.
Steve Winwood is incredible, isn't he?
What a voice. What a
you organ know it's
player.
Him.
What a Hammond player. Of course. You can even tell he's Hammond playing. But he plays guitar. He plays everything. He is an amazing musician and an amazing artist. And at this time, in the Spencer Davis Group, he was still working with his brother, Muff Winwood. Not Big Muff, which is the fuzz pedal. No other type of Muff. We're talking about Muff Winwood, and that's his name. Who went on later on, of course, to manage Wishbone Ash. But that's something different. But this track was produced by Jimmy Miller. Now, Jimmy Miller, we did a show on him very early on in our podcast. It was a very long one because, I mean, Jimmy Miller worked with unbelievable artists. He worked on the Rolling Stones' Beggar's Banquet with Spooky Tooth. He worked with Traffic, of course.
You've got a great memory, you know, because I forget.
Blind Faith, yeah. Ginger Baker's Air Force.
Wow.
You know, loads with Motorhead. You know, the Overkill and Bomber, those. And most, probably one of his most famous production jobs was Primal Scream and Screamadelica. And that was one of the last albums he did before he died. And an amazing producer. But this song is fantastic.
It's another song that makes you feel it's 67.
Totally.
It has that feel about it. The Spencer Davis Group, you know, were formed by a Welsh guitarist.
Ooh.
In Birmingham.
The E-43.
E-43. My nana was born in Glamorgan. And Spencer Davis was the Welsh guitarist and he bumped into Steve Winwood, who was 14 and still at school. And his brother, Muff, who played bass, and they were performing at the Golden Eagle Pub as the Muff Woody Jazz Band. And he recruited them and Pete York on drums, and they had this band called the Rhythm and Blues Quartet. And this is the link, you see, because in 64, they signed with Chris Blackwell of Island Records,
of course,
who saw them at a local club. Mm. So he went on to become their producer and to work with them as well. And that's when Muff, when the boys split in 67 later on. So Steve went on to form Traffic and then later on Blind Faith. And Muff moved into the music industry as an A&R man for Island.
That's right.
So, but it's who you know, isn't it? But he said that the reason why they came up with the name of the band, Spencer Davis Group, was that Spencer was the only one who enjoyed doing the interviews. So he pointed out that if we called it the Spencer Davis Group, the rest of us could stay in bed and let him get on with it.
That's a great story.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. 'Cause I've left that girl so many times before. By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. But she'll just hear that phone keep on ringing off the wall. That's all. By the time I make Oklahoma, she'll be sleeping. she'll turn softly, call my name out low. And she'll cry just to think I'd really leave her. Though time and time I've tried to tell her so, she just didn't know I would really go.
Remarkable sound of Glen Campbell, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, released as a lead single on the 23rd of October 1967 and was the opening track of his seventh studio album, the same name, released a month later on Capitol Records. It won two Grammy Awards for the Best Vocal and Male and Best Contemporary Male Vocal Solo Vocal Performance. So it was the first country album to win a Grammy for the album of the year in 1968.
Huge.
Broadcast Music Inc., that's BMI, it named the third most performed song in 1940 to 1990, and it's ranked at number 20 on their top 100 songs of the century, and written by Jimmy Webb. Ka-ching. That's two he wrote.
MacArthur Park.
Yeah.
And this one.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't want to tell you earlier, though, because I wanted to keep it, I had some notes, a little bit of a surprise, but both songs were inspired by his ex-girlfriend, Susan.
No.
Yeah. And when they split up, she ended up marrying Linda Ronstadt's cousin called Bobby. So, yeah, that was... And Frank Sinatra called this song the greatest torch song ever written. So, I mean, you've got that amazing, amazing guy. I can't believe it's incredible that he's done MacArthur Park and this song.
Yeah, and Up, Up and Away, of course. But we had another one.
Well, it just can't take it in, can you?
No, it's amazing. So in that year, you know, 1968, you know, it's amazing. But I think it's like that songwriters now, I think. They actually capture the moment, don't they? And they do stuff that actually just seems to fit in with what is happening in a scene, and they sort of connect with that particular scene, and he clearly did this. But you know, you listen to the lyric is magnificent, the arrangement is great, recorded at Capitol Studios, you know, the orchestration, everything. And I love Glen Campbell. You know?
Can I just say as well, right? So Glen Campbell was one of my mum's favorite artists. Well, this to me is home as a child. It makes me feel like I'm 1.5 foot tall, running around going, yeah, Mum, let's put some vinyl on. So,
is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, beautiful. I want to dedicate this song to her, actually, Margaret, because to me, I just loved hearing her sing along to all the music, you know. She's one of my inspirations as well, just because she just loved music so much, and it was very much a part of my life growing up. And but with Glen Campbell, you don't realise how amazingly talented this guy was.
Yeah.
So I just want to talk about Glen just a little bit. So let's have a look at this guy, you know. And I know, sadly, he passed away recently. But if you look at his career, right, he released over 70 albums in a career that spanned five decades. He sold over 45 million records worldwide, okay? And it's like 12 gold albums, four platinum albums, and one double platinum album. And when you think about where he started off, he's, of course, a Campbell.
Indeed he is.
Which means he's got Scottish descent.
Right, okay.
Of course, okay. And we were married in Inverary, which is the seat of Clan Campbell.
We were, that's right, on the banks of Loch Fyne.
Exactly. So it's just, it's like we're related. It's fantastic. I hadn't actually thought. It's weird, isn't it? But it's like, oh, yeah. So Glen was the seventh son of 12 children. And he lived on a farm where they barely managed, you know, and they grew up they grew cotton and corn, watermelons and potatoes. And they had no electricity, and they picked cotton for other farmers because money was scarce. And he said a dollar in those days looked as big as a saddle blanket. So he started playing guitar at age four, and his dad bought him a $5 guitar. And his uncle Boo taught him a few basics. And by age six, he was playing guitar on local radio.
Is that right?
How, like, 6 years old? What is going on there? And everything changed when he moved to LA in 1960. He found a daytime job at American Music, which is a publishing company, where he wrote songs and he recorded demos. And because of these demos, he was soon in demand as a session musician, and he became part of a group of studio musicians known as the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think a lot of people realise that, but Glen Campbell was an absolutely superbly talented musician who was his studio music, session musician before he left that career to go on and become an artist in his own right.
Well, his guitar playing is ridiculous. I mean, you see some of those, because he was an actor. He actually,
oh yeah,
you know,
and I remember also seeing him in a film. What was it now? Was it True Grit or something like that?
Yeah, that's
it
right.
It was.
Yeah,
he got a nomination for a Golden Globe, you know, for Most Promising Newcomer. Well, that was in 69.
But that was a marvelous film. I mean, you know.
It was really good, wasn't he?
Get off your horse and
it's
drink.
It's my dad's favourite film as well.
Yeah. Did he ever say that, John Wayne? I can never remember now, but I can always remember, fill your hands, you son of a bitch, you know. when he's about to write and he goes shooting with his two, blasting it again. It's two six shooters.
I remember that scene right at the end.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, God, Rooster Cockburn, I used to have to watch that all the time.
Yeah.
Every time.
Well,
anyway,
I just love it. Anyway.
But so Glenn, right, if you listen, he's on recordings with the Beach Boys, Bobby Darin, Dean Martin, Nat King Cole, the Monkees, Nancy Sinatra, Merle Haggard, Frank Sinatra, Phil Spector, and Elvis Presley as well. Now, that's just incredible. And he said that he met Presley when he recorded the soundtrack for the film Viva Las Vegas in 64.
Right.
And later on he said, Elvis and I were brought up in the same humble way, picking cotton and looking at the north end of a south-bound mule.
Children behave, that's what they say.
Listening to the Supertones Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Tommy James and the Shondells, I Think We're Alone Now. And that was the title track from their third studio album, released in 1967 on the Roulette record label. It was also released as a single on the 5th of January in 67, and it reached number four on the Billboard Hot 100 chart and went to number one in Canada.
Again.
Now, so Tiffany didn't do the original then?
Well, that was about to say, because when this came up, right, and we were looking at 1967, and you played it to me, I thought, God, that's a Tiffany song, and because that's the only one I can remember.
Yeah,
and that version is like just so. It's almost exactly the same. It's a very, very similar sound, isn't it? You know,
and it was a shopping mall song of the time. Whenever she released, I can't remember now. I just remember the sort of 80s hairstyles.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could do with one of those coiffures, darling. I think that'd be great.
I used to have one. Just so you know,
I am not even gonna contemplate it. It was 1987, August 1987.
Yeah, I used to have like the big sort of big hair with like shaved sides. My hairdresser was a hairdressing champion.
Is that right?
Oh, I used to go to Gloucester all the time. I can't remember his name now, but it was an experience.
For American friends, that's a Gloucester.
Oh, Gloucester. Yeah. I think his name was John, actually. It's a while back now.
John.
But so Tiffany didn't do this. A guy called Tommy James and the Shondells.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never heard of the Roulette record label before.
No.
And just before we move on, it had a bit of a connection with organised crime.
No.
Yeah, because they didn't actually pay up. So a couple of the guys of the band left. And one of the characters, let's have a look now, what's his name? Morris Levy, who was actually the guy who ran Roulette, right? He was the inspiration for the Herman Hesh Rabkin character in The Sopranos.
No, is that right?
Yeah. So we've always said there are some
shady
characters in the music industry, and like Don Arden being one as well, because he used to rip people off for money, didn't he?
Terrible, yeah. So, yeah. And his heavies,
yeah. So I think we're alone now. It was originally like a mid-tempo ballad, but it was written by Richie Cordell, who also wrote Money Money and co-produced Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll. Just,
wow.
You know. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? So Money Money, yeah, I think they saw that kind of, it was like a neon sign. It was like something of New York, Monies of New York or something. Anyway, so they wrote that song. So anyway, Richie wrote this, and it was a mid-tempo ballad. But Tommy James sped it up, and he put on like this nasally, almost juvenile-sounding lead vocal. And without realising it, he kind of helped invent bubblegum music.
Wow. Yeah, that's it. But he hated the whole bubblegum thing, and he went on. He said he changed his style to psychedelic rock.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
it's
a
like,
bad thing to do.
I actually don't blame him for doing that, by the way. I mean, but then it goes on to say he was actually invited to play Woodstock and he declined. It's like, come on.
Oh, dear.
I mean,
whoops, isn't that?
But also later, I mean, it's so complicated with him. And just one other thing, you know, in 1970, though, he had a bad reaction to drugs and died.
Is that right?
But he recovered and decided to go and just leave.
He died and recovered?
Yes. This is the wiki, by the way. So it literally says verbatim, he died and recovered.
Wow.
And he decided that he better sort himself out. So that was, you know, he's very, very, very lucky to sort of come back from that one.
Mm.
So he's got a long history. It's so complex. It's kind of boring because I just want to enjoy and celebrate his song now, because he, you know, it's Tommy James and the Shondells.
Like the sweet magnolia tree, my love blossoms.
James Jameson. No, sorry, Stevie Wonder. I Was Made to Love Her. The title track from his seventh studio album released 28th of August 1967 on the Tamla Motown Records label, a subsidiary of Motown. And, of course, when I say James Jameson, I'm talking about the bass player, the magnificent James Jameson.
You really surprised me then. Yeah, I know. I was so excited when I read that he was playing on that. Well, you can tell, can't
you? Can you? Tell. He was all over it. And I still think he's too busy, but everybody raves about him.
I agree with you,
you know. But it's a lovely performance, you know. But that's the end of the show, I'm afraid.
I know, but just before we go, you know, that went to number two on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. It got kept off the number one spot by The Doors and Light My Fire.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it was co-written by Stevie and his mum, Lula.
Well,
she was an American
surprise.
Songwriter. Yeah, and another guy, the producer Henry and Sylvia Moy. You didn't know that, did you?
Stevie
Wonder's mum was a songwriter. Fantastic.
Amazing.
So this song we're going to play the show out with, I hope you've enjoyed this one. I'm so excited about 1967. It's a sound of the year. You can feel it. It was number one in the USA. It didn't even chart in the UK. And it's a song by Strawberry Alarm Clock called Incense and Peppermint. Catch you next week.
Mankind, dead kings, many things I can't define. Occasions, spots, wagons, clutter your mind. In the sense of compliments, the color of time.
Who cares what games we choose? Little to win, but nothing to lose.
In the sense of compliments, meaningless nouns. Turn on, tune in, turn your eyes around.
Look what you saw.
Tootle by the cockeyed world in two. Throw you by the one side, the least you can do. Beat makes and politics, nothing is new. A yardstick for lunatics, one point of view.
To win, but nothing to lose.